that if you can. The Czech Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Václav Talik in Dvořák's Slavonic Dance Opus 72, number 7, recorded in Prague in June 1939. And that's it from me this morning. I hope you've enjoyed the programme as much as I have. Next week, James Jolly's going to be with you, and it'll be a great programme, I know. And I'll be with you again tomorrow at 9 o'clock with Essential Classics.
Sunday Morning with Rob Cowan is a perfectly normal production for BBC Radio 3, with studio production this morning by Lyndon Jones. This is BBC Radio 3. It's now midday and time for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
Michael Grandage made an extraordinarily successful transition from actor to director when, in 1995, he directed Arthur Miller's The Last Yankee in Colchester. He became an associate director at Sheffield and succeeded Sam Mendes at the Donmar Warehouse in 2002. This is his last season there as artistic director. Amongst his many credits are Guys and Dolls, Frost Nixon, and Red, a wonderful examination of Mark Rothko's relationship with his work and his assistant. Opera is now part of his portfolio, Billy Budd at Glyndebourne last year and Don Giovanni at the Met this year. Let's just go back a minute, Michael, to that transition which I mentioned, because it almost sounds like one of those incredibly fortuitous things which completely changed your life.
Well, that's what it was. So it's right to see it like that, in a way. The acting career, which I'd enjoyed enormously, was something that wasn't working, and I needed to find other things to do, and I didn't know that directing could be one of them. It was just something I was talking to Pat Truman, who was running Colchester at the time, about, and she said, why don't you come and do a production here? And that first production showed me that there was an alternative.
Can you describe in a way what it was that you sort of discovered? Was it just that you felt free in working with actors, that ideas came to you and you were able to communicate to them?
As an actor, you have to consider your performance and how that performance interacts with others. As a director, you can enjoy freedom, is a good word, actually. You enjoy the freedom of coming up with a vision for the piece that you then have to communicate to others, starting with the design team and then the actors, and in doing so, you can go on a much, a much more satisfying journey than I was enjoying at the time.
And clearly, music has always been quite important.
Yes, I mean, music has been important from much earlier, and indeed before I even became an actor. I was very fortunate that I went to a school, the Humphrey Davy Grammar School in Penzance, which is now the Humphrey Davy School, I think, and had an extraordinary music teacher, a man called Russell Jury, who, when I was studying music under him, I did O-level and A-level music, he suggested that he wasn't worried that we didn't get our A-levels, but he was very clear that we wanted to go out of the school with a great understanding and appreciation of music.
It's extraordinary. I mean, so many people have been through this room talking about music, and it's amazing how very often just one teacher turned the key to the door on some subject, especially to do with culture, and showed people what there was there. And it's a very valuable gift.
It's a huge gift, and it was the way into everything for me. There are so many things I can see clearly about the way he, for instance, I remember he conducted the school choir once that I was in with such vigour. He stabbed himself with his own baton. And I have a very strong image of him holding his clenched fist bleeding while conducting us. And all I can remember thinking is, this is absolutely wonderful.
And the rest of us all knew you were destined for opera from there on.
Yeah, exactly.
But it's not opera we're going to begin with. It's a piece that you actually studied for the A-levels you were mentioning.
That's right. This piece by Palestrina, the Missa Papa Marcelli, was one of our A-level pieces. The Kyrie was, particularly. And choral music was something we were being made aware of. Well, those of us that were in the choir with him, he had a huge repertoire, Russell Jury, and wanted to explore it all with the students. And so we were open to many choral experiences. But because we had to study this, it became something quite specific over a whole year. And it became quite an important piece for me. It's interesting that things sometimes you're made to study as a youngster don't usually translate into a lifelong enjoyment. It's something that puts you off quite often, but because of the passion that went into trying to get us to understand it, it has a purity and a simplicity and an honesty, I think, that now I hear it and think, when you said earlier about what attracts you to directing, well, I think all of those qualities, is you'd be lucky to get some of them.
The Kyrie from Missa Pape Macelli by Palestrina. We heard the Talis Scholars, directed by Peter Phillips. So while you were at school, Michael Grander, did you actually study an instrument as well?
I did. I studied the horn. The tenor horn, actually, is what I studied. Tenor horn in E-flat. I was part of the Penzance Silver Band, and I enjoyed it enormously. But when I went to the school, I came into contact with an amazing horn teacher, French horn teacher, called Charles Gregory. Quite an eminent horn player himself. He'd retired to Cornwall and was teaching. And he persuaded me to change instrument from the tenor horn to the French horn. And he said it'll open up a whole different repertoire. He was certainly right there. He was another teacher who was less obsessed about turning me into a... Well, actually, he clearly saw I wasn't going to be turned into a brilliant horn player, but he was determined to make me appreciate the repertoire, teach me things that would help me through the repertoire. And I did all the grades. And one of the pieces I had to study at length was the Horn Concerto No. 2.
Of Mozart,
correct.
I mean, the horn is a difficult instrument, isn't it? I mean, the embouchure and all of that.
Yeah, it's really difficult. And I found the tenor horn much easier, actually. The French horn was far more difficult. But I persevered, and I got quite a lot of satisfaction out of it. But you never get total satisfaction out of something you know you're not brilliant at.
So we probably get slightly more satisfaction from hearing Dennis Byrne play.
Much, much more. Thank you. used to listen to that piece nearly every week, once a week, throughout my entire teenage years, thinking, why, oh, why can't I sound like Dennis Brain?
Dennis Brain playing the third movement from the Mozart Hochkonzert No. 2 in E-flat major, Kochel 417, with the Philharmonia Orchestra, conducted by Herbert von Karajan. We were talking just now about music and how, in one sense, describing coming to terms with it through studying it, which gives one a language in which to sort of discuss things. But I was very fascinated by Red, the play that you produced at the Donmar Warehouse, which was an extraordinary insight into the workings of the mind of that great painter, Mark Rothko. And you might think, I suppose, that his pictures are a bit like music, an abstract language that it's quite difficult to talk around.
The real interest to me about Red as a play was more about the mentor-student relationship, and particularly the idea that the senior figure gets as much out of that relationship as the younger person. And it's interesting, isn't it, that even sitting here talking to you about how much I've got from things that have stayed with me all my life from good teachers, it's clearly something that is a very potent subject.
There was a not entirely dissimilar relationship, I think, between Shostakovich and Rostropovich. Mm. I remember meeting them both at one point. There was the senior man who was very insular and sort of hidden behind these thick glasses. And there was Rostropovich, who was extremely outgoing and immediately gave you a bear hug the minute he saw you, if he'd ever even met you once before. Because clearly Rostropovich loved this music so much, but he was the voice through which it could speak in a way.
Well, it's wonderful to hear you talk about them in that way, because I, of course, knew neither, but got to know Shostakovich through Rostropovich, really, because there was an extraordinary series of concerts, and I cannot remember the year now, because it all, I think it might have been 1988, but it might even be 1998, but it was Music from the Flames at the Barbican, or predominantly at the Barbican, in which Rostropovich and the LSO, I think he conducted most of the symphonies, and certainly the purpose of the festival was to take all of Shostakovich's music. I went to every single concert. I became obsessed and devoted, I suppose, but one of the most extraordinary things was watching this man, this great musician, Rostropovich, interpret his friend and colleague's work, and how he seemed to get inside the work and then communicate. I had some of the most extraordinary afternoons and evenings in a concert hall during that period that I've ever had. I remember very clearly the performance of the Fifth Symphony. He had the most amazing way with the orchestra that I will never forget that performance. At the end of it, he abandoned his baton altogether, threw it away, and conducted the final moments with his fists. Just and then when it was all over, I remember somebody brought in a basket of flowers on the podium, and he took the score and he lifted it aloft and then stuffed it into this basket of flowers, and we all in the audience went berserk. It was a truly memorable moment.
Thank you. majestic yet anguished cadence from the fourth movement of the Symphony No. 5 in D minor, Opus 47, by Shostakovich. The National Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Mstislav Rostropovich. I imagine you have used quite a lot of music in productions, and that's probably introduced you to quite a few things, because you search for the right atmosphere, the right kind of piece.
Yeah, I mean, one of the most wonderful things as my career has developed is a budget for a composer.
It's always good to hear that.
Yeah, it's fantastic for me as well, because it's another relationship that is another collaboration. And I've been lucky enough to work with two brilliant composers, Adam Cork and Julian Phillips, in my time. But at the beginning of my directing career, there was no such thing as a budget for a composer, and I drew on a lot of other music that I'd either come across in my life or had been recommended to me to try and get the tone of the piece right. I found a lot of success in the work of Malcolm Arnold. It wasn't just for one, but two or three productions early on that I used Malcolm Arnold.
He was a very good film composer.
He was a wonderful film composer, and he offers a narrative in his music sometimes that is very, very helpful for the dramatic narrative of a play. And I quite often took a piece of his and edited it a little to help us through the piece, but it became, you know, I mean, listen, how many directors? I should be so lucky. But who's your composer? Sir Malcolm Arnold. It was very good. One of the earliest productions I did was a production of Rattigan's Deep Blue Sea, and I found Malcolm Arnold's Concerto for Two Pianos and Orchestra, the slow movement, to be the most perfect piece to support the play. It was a great match.
Because the overall sensibility of this movement is what?
Well, there's a melancholia to the movement, which is great for the piece. There's also something very repressed in the music, and occasionally in the music it explodes, and there are extraordinary moments of explosion in the play that the characters have, and the whole of the pulse, the narrative pulse of the music and the play seem to work very well together.
I think several composers either wrote or rearranged, especially for Cyril Smith, because he had a stroke, didn't he, and could only use one hand.
That's right, in 1956, I believe, and he built up a career playing three-handed duos with his wife, Phyllis Selleck. It's a remarkable piece, just listening to it again. I mean, I'm not sure now. It was very early on in my directing career I used that piece, and I'm wondering now whether one would go in a completely different direction, but it did definitely support that emotional range.
We heard Phyllis Selleck and Cyril Smith playing the pianos with the City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra, conducted by the composer Malcolm Arnold, in the second movement of his Concerto for Two Pianos and Orchestra, Opus 104. Michael Granage, you did something which I imagine in some ways was a bit brave, because there was a very famous production of Guys and Dolls by Richard Eyre, wasn't there, at the National?
Mm.
And you then did a new production. So it was a sort of bit of a track record to follow up on.
Yes, I saw that original production well over six times. I think I may have even seen it seven or eight times, but I was a student at the time, and it was quite an interesting moment because I think I'd been a bit of a musical snob up until that National Theatre production. And I discovered this, I mean, it's an extraordinary book musical, Guys and Dolls, but in that production, there was really brilliant acting going on. And it opened my eyes in a way that I hadn't really seen before about the possibilities of musical theatre and the way with casting and the way with presentation. It was beautifully directed by Richard Eyre. It was an astonishing, and it was also a great moment for the National Theatre. The National Theatre let its hair down with that production, and we were all there for it.
But don't you think also that, I mean, there are an awful lot of rather sentimental musicals which one might be entitled to feel a little bit snobbish about, but it is one of those musicals which is musically very brilliant in a way.
Yeah, it is. It's one of the reasons when I was offered to direct it, I couldn't say no, because it was, I felt it was part of me, it was part of my growing up. And seeing Ian Charlson and Julie Covington sing the song at the end of the first half, I've Never Been in Love Before, and indeed My Time of Day that he does just before that, I will never forget that. It's a truly great piece of theatre, not just musical theatre.
My time of day is the dark time, a couple of deals before dawn, when the street belongs to the cop and the janitor with the mop, and the grocery clerks are all gone. When the smell of the rain-washed pavement comes up clean and fresh and cold, and a street lamp light fills the gutter with gold, that's my time of day. And you're the only doll I've ever wanted to share it with me. I've never been in love before. Now all at once it's you forevermore. I've never been in love before. I thought my heart was safe. I thought I knew the score. But this is wine, it's all too strange and strong. I'm full of foolish song, and out my song must pour. So please forgive this helpless haze I'm in. I've really never been in love.
Never Been in Love Before, preceded by My Time of Day. Music from Guys and Dolls, the Frank Lerser score. We heard Ian Charlson and Julie Covington from the original National Theatre cast recording. Actually, I remember also a wonderful performance by David Healy as Nicely, Nicely Johnson.
Yeah, absolutely wonderful. It was amazing. The whole thing, it was a perfect evening. And it's interesting listening to it again there. The orchestration, obviously, was very much of its time in the 1980s. And
Glockenspiel.
Yeah, there was a bit of going on, but it was just fantastic. And it was daunting coming to it.
What did you do different there? I mean, did you take a decision to slightly go in a different direction?
Well, yes. I mean, believe it or not, it was something like 25 years since that original production. I think one of the things had happened is it had been revived a lot. And so it wasn't 25 years in some people's minds, but it was certainly 25 years since I'd seen it. And quite a lot of time had passed. And so I think we were able to revisit it in many ways. We wanted to... All directors say this. We wanted to go back to the stories they were based on. But in doing so, we actually found it quite liberating. And it just did something with the gangster world that was helpful and made us and opened it up a bit. And we were also blessed with four phenomenal leads in the performance. And musically, it was wonderful because one of the four, the role of Nathan Detroit in the version I did, was played by Doug Hodge. Nathan Detroit doesn't actually have many great songs in Guys and Dolls, but when he came in to talk about it, I said, "Do you sing?" He said, "Yeah, I really sing. I sing and I write my own songs as well." And I had no idea. And I went out and got a copy of an album he'd released called Cowley Road Songs to find that this person I'd known all my life was this rather extraordinary singer-songwriter. And when I was growing up in the 70s, alongside all that classical music I was studying, I was, you know, listening to lots of Bob Dylan, Billy Joel, and I sort of grew out of Tom Waits a bit, but I loved him at the time and was great. But then I suddenly realised I know somebody who writes their own songs. And the fascinating thing is, I don't know Doug well. We just were friends and colleagues. But somehow, through his songs, I feel I've got to know him a great deal better.
I can't wait for you. I can't wait for you. You make me your Yes, you do. With that first last look in the shadows, after all those still to come, you're a cool glass of water to quench my thirst. You're the But I wish I found you first. I can't wait for you. I can't wait for you. You make me your witness. Yes, you do. With that first last look in the shadow. After all those still to come, I could keep my feelings silent, but my heart would burst. I could shout it from
suddenly violent. You could all turn out for the worst, but I wish I'd found you first before the world turns round again, before
was a first for me, actually, because I know Douglas Hodges' work as an actor, of course, but I never had the slightest idea that he wrote and sang songs.
Isn't it? It's wonderful. It's an amazing album, actually.
Wished I'd Found You First by Doug Hodge from his album Cowley Road Songs. We're talking about Malcolm Arnold and you finding that music useful for the theatre. And I think it's a sort of fascinating art form in itself, really, because it mustn't take away too much. I mean, if it's so striking and so portentous in a sense, unless, of course, that's what you want, that if you have a great classic sort of booming away, it doesn't help. So the art of writing music, which is both supportive but in some ways invisible.
The one thing you go to the theatre to watch is the acting. If you say, I like the direction, then something's wrong. If you say you like the lighting, something's wrong. Or like the lighting ahead of anything else, or the design ahead of anything else. And it's the same with music, and there are many other people who collaborate as well in putting on a show. But it's a team that needs to, you're right, supporting the work, helping it through the journey of the piece. And I've been blessed to work with two wonderful composers in my time as a director. Adam Cork I've worked with for nearly a decade and is somebody who completely understands what you say about supporting the piece and not being too evident.
It's kind of subsuming your own identity into the corporate body.
That's
right.
That's exactly what it is, yeah. Yeah, it is. And the person who I worked with in the early part of my career, after Malcolm Arnold, was Julian Phillips, who is an orchestral composer, and he understands wonderfully what's needed from the production. Interestingly, I did a lot of Shakespeare with him, and so he did quite often have to compose some of the Shakespeare songs as well as some of the incidental music. And one production that we worked on together, which was The Tempest, when Derek Jacobi played Prospero, we did that in Sheffield when I was up there. And indeed, we did bring it to London. We brought it to the Old Vic as well. But Julian wrote all the music for that. And Daniel Evans, who is now running Sheffield Theatres, played Ariel. And I did want to choose a piece of work by one of the people I've collaborated with because their music has been so important to the last 15, 20 years of my life.
When you haven't kissed the wild wave. watchdogs bark. Hark, hark, I hear the strain of strutting chanticleer, cry cock-a-diddle-dow.
Daniel Evans singing Come Unto These Yellow Sands, Julian Phillips's song from his incidental music from The Tempest. I mentioned, Michael, that you were well into opera now, and you're going to be immersing yourself in Mozart quite a bit. And I suppose that's a bit like immersing yourself in Shakespeare, in a sense.
Yes, I guess it is. And... Well, in that you're immersing yourself in a genius, and also in the opera world, of course, in pieces that are done regularly, like Shakespeare is done regularly in the theatre. So there's also a parallel there, which interpreting these pieces and making them feel fresh and new, or at least new for an audience that you're doing it for at the time you're doing it, is part of the challenge. And it's a challenge I relish. I am moving out of my comfort zone in opera, which is why one of the reasons I'm doing it and why I'm enjoying it, actually. After 15 years of getting used to working out how you direct a play and still learning, now I'm doing something similar, but with singers and with a conductor, with an orchestra. You know, there's a whole load of things that I've never worked with before, and that is a wonderful challenge.
But is the essential process very different?
Well... No, the essential process isn't different. The essential process of coming up with a vision for the piece and then collaborating with a group of people and taking everyone on a journey together and being in a rehearsal room talking about building character and talking about backstory even. Or no, all of that remains the same. I suppose the big difference is... Well, the biggest difference is something that nobody had prepared me for, actually, which is that opera singers, of course, sing a role for the first time and then go around the world quite frequently singing the same role in new productions. That's something that doesn't happen in the theatre. You know, if an actor plays Hamlet, that's usually their Hamlet done. They don't then go abroad or to another theatre somewhere else and play Hamlet in another production. Rarely. Occasionally, but rarely. Opera singers come to you having quite often sung it many times before.
So you almost, if you want to do something original, have to unlearn them, as it were.
Well, you'd think so, wouldn't you? But I find that they unlearn it themselves for you quite often. And this production of Billy Budd I did in 2010 in Glyndebourne.
With Mark Elder.
With Mark Elder. Mm. Was a fascinating experience because some of the singers had sung it before and some hadn't. John Mark Ainsley, who sang Captain Vere, had sung Vere before, but came to the rehearsal room very open and clearly brought stuff that he had learnt and wanted to use, but didn't at any point say, this is what I've learnt and this is what I want to use, because part of him was open to a new production. Similarly so, Philip Entz, who played Claggett, had sung it in many productions all over the world. He was the most fascinating for me, though, because I rather... controversially set it on board a ship, the HMS Indomitable, which is where it is set. But I didn't realise I was being quite so controversial, because there was one day in rehearsals where Philip Entz, who had sung Claggett many, many times in his life, stopped and said he was having some difficulty. And I said, let's talk about what this difficulty is. He said, no, the difficulty is I've never sung it on board a ship before and I don't quite know what to do here. And I thought that was a fascinating insight into the way opera productions can work sometimes with the singers. And the environment that they sing it in can inform their emotional and intellectual trajectory, if you like. And so there was I, thinking I was being... you know, relatively okay putting on stuff. It turned out to be an avant-garde director by the sounds of it.
Let's hear a moment from it, because the music does create such an evocative sense of sea and drama, and of course so extraordinary that this is an all-male cast. Mm. I mean, a major achievement to bring that off in itself. But the orchestral writing is wonderful, even in its own right.
Yeah, well, it was the largest orchestra of any Britain opera. And it's certainly employed. And I was blessed because I had the great Sir Mark Elder as my first, it was my first opera, and there he was guiding me through this musically. I did know it quite well. I'd seen it many times, and we were very clear what we wanted to do.
I'm sure he was reassured when you said to him, I do know it quite well.
Yeah, well, I didn't come as a complete novice to the piece. But what he was wonderful at doing, just in terms of somebody doing their first opera, was he was totally unpatronising about the whole experience. He was a genuine collaborator. He's passionate about the work he does. He's passionate about everybody else's bit of the work. So he was a total collaborator. He wanted to be in part of the discussions of the design and every single element of it. And so in return, I was part of all of the musical elements with him. And it was a genuine collaboration. And from that point of view, it was a very exciting start to an opera career.
There are some chords which I think you particularly like in the second act.
Well, I like them because it's a wonderful illustration of what opera is good at, in a way, because it's an offstage scene, and therefore it's done only with the orchestra and the people in the audience. It's the collaboration, in this case, between the stage and the auditorium. And it's a series of chords that happen when Captain Veer goes off to inform Billy of his death sentence.
The thing about Britain is that there are no extraneous notes. When you look at the score, it almost looks empty sometimes because he hears everything so perfectly that he doesn't clutter.
He is also clearly a man of the theatre as well. That's a pure theatrical moment, and he had great confidence as a composer there. And talk about a learning curve for me as well. The idea that you can just leave the stage empty. if you've secured a really strong narrative, as there is up until that point, and then for Veer to leave the stage, and you know where he's going, geographically, you know where he's going within the ship, because Billy has also just gone there, and he leaves in order to have this encounter, and then you just have that series of chords. It shows great authority and maturity to be able to take an audience on that journey. And for me, I learnt, don't feel you've always got to do something. Leaving it to the music, leaving it to just a picture where there is no visual picture happening on, but your mind can take you on that journey. It's a wonderful theatrical moment in the piece.
It's the corollary of having the confidence to be silent.
Yeah, exactly that.
And in fact, there's a marvellous moment in Wozzeck, you know, the D minor Passacaglia, which is somehow what finally turns the knife in the wound just almost unbearably. We heard music from Act 2, Scene 2 of Benjamin Britten's Billy Budd, and that was the recording with the London Symphony Orchestra conducted by Richard Hickox. You're coming to the end of your period running Donmar. Is that partially because you wanted more time just to do your own productions?
Well, I've been able to do my own productions at the Donmar, which has been great for the last 10 years. I just think it's a good moment to move on. 5 years running Sheffield, 10 years running the Donmar seemed to me a wonderful period of being building-based. And I've always been able to do the work I've wanted to do. It's just that there are other opportunities now, not least the opera that we've talked about is coming through. But I also think it's a moment for me to be able to go off and investigate other opportunities outside of the subsidised sector, outside of building-based theatres, simply because, as I said, the experience of being out of my comfort zone was so liberating. It suggested this is a moment to actually move on and move forward.
Michael Grandage, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Michael Grandage was talking to Michael Barclay. Next week at the same time, Michael's guest on Private Passions will be Margaret Mountford, one of Lord Sugar's original team of expert advisers on The Apprentice. Private Passions is a classic arts production for Radio 3, and the producer of today's programme was Sarah Cropper.
Weekday mornings on BBC Radio 3.
I'm Rob Cowan.
I'm Sarah Walker.
Presenting a brand new programme called Essential Classics. And when I say essential, I mean essential. Both the repertoire that we're choosing and the recordings of works that we're going to play on the programme will be of exceptional quality.
I think there's going to be enough variety to keep you entertained.
I think it's going to be a highlight of many people's mornings.
Your essential start to the working day.
Great music, plenty of it.
This is Essential Classics.
Weekday mornings from 9 until 12 on BBC Radio 3.
You're listening to BBC Radio 3. We're on 90 to 93 FM, on digital radio and also online. The time is 1 o'clock. Time for the news with Vaughan Savage.
David Cameron has dismissed criticism of the government's economic strategy and insisted that it's firing up the engines of the British economy. Speaking in Manchester on the opening day of the Conservative conference, the Prime Minister promised increased discounts to help council tenants buy their homes. When the Tories introduced the original right-to-buy scheme in the 1980s, they were criticised for reducing the stock of social housing. But under the new proposals, a new home would be built for each one sold. Greater Manchester Police say 1,000 officers have been deployed in the city ahead of a mass protest organised by the TUC. It's expected that 30,000 people will march through parts of Manchester and nearby Salford. Conditions in the Libyan city of Sirte, one of the last remaining strongholds of forces loyal to Colonel Gaddafi, have been described as dire by the Red Cross. Doctors at a hospital say hundreds of injured people need treatment, but there is no power or water. Afghan officials have said that the killer of the former president and peace envoy, Burhanuddin Rabbani, was Pakistani. In a statement, they said the murder was plotted in the Pakistani city of Quetta. Yesterday, President Karzai said that he was abandoning attempts to negotiate with the Taliban and would instead directly deal with Pakistan. Britain and France have extended their travel warnings for people visiting Kenya, with the Foreign Office advising against all but essential travel to a stretch of Kenya's coast. Yesterday, a French woman was kidnapped near the border with Somalia, 3 weeks after a British woman was seized and her husband murdered. West Yorkshire police have arrested a 37-year-old man following a fatal fire in Ragby. 2-year-old Isabel Dobson died in the fire on Friday evening. Police in Lancashire are investigating the death of a baby whose body was found by a dog walker. The baby, thought to have been about 2 months old, was found in a culvert in Kirkham. The weather, it will remain warm and sunny in the Midlands and southern England throughout the afternoon. It will be cooler and cloudier elsewhere with outbreaks of rain. The BBC News and Weather at 2:30 past one.
Read by Vaughan Savage. I'm Jill Anderson. Very good afternoon to you. In an hour's time at 2 o'clock in our Sunday concert, we'll be hearing a performance of Schubert's song cycle Winterreise, performed by the baritone Christian Gerhaher and the pianist Gerald Huber. That's followed at 4 o'clock by Choral Evensong from Winchester Cathedral for the eve of the Feast of St Michael and All Angels. It's sung by the cathedral choirs of Chichester, Salisbury and Winchester. But now it's time for today's early music show. Here's Lucy Skeeping.
Today's programme begins in a rather uncomfortable environment, a prison in The Hague. It was October 1593, and languishing in solitary confinement was a tall, dark-haired, respectable-looking foreigner, an Englishman in his early 30s called Peter Phillips. He was a composer, he argued vehemently to the authorities, not a Catholic spy, and certainly not involved in any plot to kill Queen Elizabeth. What's more, he insisted, he'd only stopped off in Middleburg because he was taken ill and, as he put it, to converse with such as delighted in music. So just how did Peter Phillips, one of the great composers of the Tudor age, end up being incarcerated like this and fearing for his life? Well, on today's programme, we're going to explore the events that led up to this moment. But first, let's hear some music. Two keyboard pieces with rather gloomy titles, thought to have been written from his prison cell, Pavana and Galliarda Dolorosa.